Please note that the opinions and perspectives shared on the Real Pharma podcast by Nari O and Ian Wendt are their own. These views do not represent the positions, strategies, or opinions of their employers or any other organizations with which they may be affiliated. Now on with the show.
All audiences, and I use the word audience to mean whether you're talking to one person on a telephone call or presenting, all audiences are tuning into the same radio station, WIFM. What's in it for me? Nobody's judging you. Nobody really cares what you had for breakfast or what's going on inside your brain. If you're talking to them, they're going, okay, how is this relevant for me? How am I going to use it? What do I need to know? What don't I need or want to know? Just give me what I need to be able to take back and do my own job better.
This is Real Pharma, your podcast for real conversations with pharma pathfinders. In every episode, you will hear from an industry insider who has a story to share that goes beyond the headlines. No spin, no sacred cows, no hidden agendas, just stories and the people behind them. Now, here are your hosts, Dr. Nari O and Ian Wendt.
Welcome back to the Real Pharma Podcast. I'm your host, Nari O, joined by the ever pertinacious Ian Wendt. In this episode, we're thrilled to welcome Dr. Laurel Sekola, a master communicator and influencer. With over two decades dedicated to transforming top-level executives into confident, inspiring leaders, Dr. Sekola's expertise in leadership communication is unparalleled. She understands that how you communicate is your brand, emphasizing the importance of not just being the brains behind the operation, but also being the face and voice in front of it. Her approach, grounded in cognitive linguistics, empowers professionals like you to effectively communicate your passion and expertise, ensuring you get the buy-in you need for the results you want. Dr. Sekola's mission revolves around guiding leaders to master the three C's of executive presence: commanding the room, connecting with the audience, and closing the deal. Her coaching and training approach is designed to project confidence, authority, and authenticity, allowing professionals to be themselves while still getting through to key stakeholders. Laura's background in cognitive linguistics, a discipline she developed during her PhD studies at the University of Pennsylvania, forms the cornerstone of her unique coaching ethos. An author, speaker, and the host of the podcast Speaking to Influence, Laura's insights into effective communication are sought after worldwide. With her TEDx talk titled, "Want to Sound Like a Leader? Start by Saying Your Name Right," having garnered almost 7 million views, Dr. Sekola has proven her ability to captivate and educate audiences on a global scale. Join us as we delve into the world of effective executive communication with Laura Sekola, exploring how mastering the art of influence can lead to professional and personal growth. Welcome to the show, Dr. Sekola.
Thank you so much, Nari. Please call me Laura.
All right.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Welcome, Laura. Thanks for your time. Really looking forward to this discussion, and I'm sure it'll be a fun one. Nari and I were just chatting that we both had a chance to watch your TEDx talk, which was great. I'd recommend it. It's 15 minutes of well-invested time. But you know, what caught my interest initially, I think, when I was finding the talk online is the title, right? Start by saying your name right. And I was pretty sure I was saying my name right. And for anybody listening, if you're wondering, are you saying your name right? I'd recommend watching the video on YouTube. You can easily find it. We'll put a link in the show notes, because it shows you that maybe we're not saying our names right. So I'll leave that there as kind of a teaser for Laura's talk. Let's start off a little bit. Let's geek out a little bit, I guess, maybe on terminology, if we could.
Sure.
Just to make sure we all have a baseline understanding on this subject. And I think I know a little bit more about it now that I watched your video. But help our audience better understand the definition of linguistics. We all know the word, but what does it really mean and in this context specifically?
Sure. That linguistics is the science of language. So by way of analogy, think of it this way. A lot of people understand how to use computers, but have no idea what makes them work per se. I can more or less, barely by some people's standards, use computers for daily purposes, but I would have no idea how to build the hardware, much less program the software, et cetera. So that's how most people are with language. Maybe they've studied a little bit of grammar and things in school, but for the most part, they just talk. They may be pretty good at writing or more confident speaking, but the linguists understand the deep mechanics, all of the nuances, all of the contextual pieces that make language language and that otherwise create the difference often between what you think you said and what they think they heard. And we figure out how to close that gap.
So is it fair to say that your research, your focus is not as much on what you say, but how you say it? Is that a simplified or oversimplified version of kind of how you think about it?
That dichotomy about the what you say versus how you say it is important, but it is mythologized in the sense that one is technically more important than another. And there's research out there that has been completely distorted over the years, the Morabian study and all, and I'm happy to go into that later if anybody cares. But it's really the idea that they are two sides of the equation, and you can't have one without the other. If you have great content, but lousy delivery, it's kind of like dipping a pearl in mud. There's good stuff in there, but you can't find it. On the flip side, having great delivery, but content that's off, content, word choice, examples, data, whatever it happens to be, that's at best putting lipstick on a pig. It might be somewhat entertaining for somebody somewhere, but it has no purpose and it's kind of inhumane to anybody else who has to be part of it, plus the pig. But really, it is all of the above. It is the words and it is the delivery. You have to pick, when you think about things like how much jargon you use, how much technical detail you go into, how much data do you use to back it up, the order of things that you present. Do you tell stories? And do you give examples that are relevant to that particular audience? That's all in the content. That's all in the what you say. But the how you say it, I'm going to date myself here, but going back to that movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off, do you remember that movie?
Sure. Yeah, classic.
Anybody in the X generation and maybe a little above that would know it, but Ben Stein's character, the economics teacher, was the quintessential example of the most boring teacher ever. And he just droned his way through everything, taking attendance, Bueller, asking questions, anyone. And everybody was just utterly asleep in the class. It was funny, but we've all had people who talk like that, whether they're bosses or colleagues or teachers or religious leaders or whoever else. And we don't realize how often we fall into that when we're on autopilot or when we're not feeling confident about something or when we're, there's so many ways that we slide into communication patterns in the delivery that are utterly self-destructive for the goals that we want to achieve through that communication. So there's my geek out moment for you, Ian.
That was great. I'm so glad we have you on the show because you're the expert. You've done your PhD in this. You can tell us everything that happens behind the scenes. And we launched this podcast early this year, and one of our episodes was about career, the job market. And we asked our listeners, what do you want to hear more of? And one of the requests that came in immediately is, can you give us some help with, for instance, interviewing or advancing your career in general through what do I do? What do I do better? And I think you're the expert to help us answer that question partially. So given how important the what and the how are, and with your expertise in cognitive linguistics, how important is the appropriate application of your science for our audience who are mostly pharma professionals? And what settings do you think does this apply to most? Is it any presentation, any interview? Is it more than that, less than that?
Not to cop out on the answer, but it's always and everywhere. Mm-hmm. The whole point is when you're communicating with someone, you have a point you're trying to make. You want to get them to understand it, accept it, support it, do what they're supposed to do, get on board, have everybody rowing in the same direction, whether it's big or small. You can't do that if you can't communicate it effectively. And I think when you're talking about career development, what a lot of people don't realize, especially people who are, and I'm going to make massive generalizations here, but on the whole, people who are in more tech numbers-oriented spaces who aren't the preferred communicators necessarily, they wouldn't say that that is one of their top skill sets or preferences. There's a natural inclination initially to work your way up the career ladder and really rely on your technical expertise, whatever that, whether it's in a laboratory, at a computer, in spreadsheets, you name it. But we don't realize that when you go up the ladder from that direction, there is what I like to refer to as a linguistic glass ceiling. And you're not going to break through that glass ceiling based on your skill set alone. It will kind of hit somewhere in the management levels. But if you want to transcend into a true leadership role, it's no longer about how well you do your job, the technical tasks that you execute. It's now this lateral shift. And you have to then, in order to rise through that ceiling, it's about how well you lead others, both those who have those skills, because you're going to be passing the torch and now delegating those tasks to somebody else to do, but also to those who don't share those skills and who aren't going to be doing those tasks. You can be in finance, but you need to talk to R&D. You need to talk to marketing. You need to talk to whoever else it happens to be, sales, and you're going to be listening to them. So how well can you translate that expertise for those who absolutely don't share it? And I know that there are a lot, and I've heard many people, many clients who are in that space and feeling stuck at that point. And there's a frustration, even those now here in the virtual world ever since COVID came along, and who kind of like the isolation of just being able to do their work and not be interrupted and not have to, quote unquote, waste time. I would say invest, but pick your verb of choice, in spending time getting to know people, to communicate more, to interact more. But here's the thing. The idea, people will often say, well, shouldn't my work speak for itself? Why can't my work speak for itself? If I do good work, I should be promoted. No, here's the problem. Your work does speak for itself. It doesn't speak for you.
Ooh, that's a nice angle. I've not heard that before. Okay. Tell us more about that.
Well, sure. If your work speaks for itself and your work is so good, and that's what people know about you, you do this job well, then what that tells decision makers is that you should stay right there and keep doing that job, because that's the only thing they know about you. You've developed no other identity for them other than someone who belongs exactly where they are doing exactly what they're doing.
You're the trusted subject matter expert, but that's it.
That's it. Mm-hmm. So they want you on the team. They want you playing shortstop, but they don't want you leading the team, coaching it, managing it. They don't want you at the head of the table. They'll ask you when they need your piece, but that's it. So if you want to be viewed as someone who belongs leading the team in some capacity, you have to show that you have leadership skills, which is absolutely not the same as having those technical skills. What proactive actions will you take to demonstrate either the desire to learn or the current possession of those other leadership skills? To lead, you must be willing to hand off those tasks that you're doing right now. Then what? Prove to people that you're ready for or willing to learn how to do those other things. And the skills that you'll need are all communication-based.
And that makes sense, right? Because we often hear at some point, it's really not about how much you know. That's just the price of entry. Everybody at that level is a subject matter expert. They're good. And that's how they got there.
Yes.
But then you have to kind of give that up a little bit. You know, have to give up that control over really being able to do what you want the way you want to. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so hard sometimes to make that transition, right? Because as you say, now all of a sudden you have to do other things that you weren't really focused on and that you have to develop, just like you developed your craft.
Steve Jobs was not a master coder. He was not the master engineer. He was the ideas person. He was the visionary. Henry Ford, I forget exactly what the context was, but he was, I don't remember if it was in the Senate or he was being challenged somewhere, but they asked him some technical questions about automobiles. And he said, here's the thing, I don't need to know. See the buttons on this phone? I know exactly which button to push to find the person who can answer that question immediately. I don't need to know. That's leadership. Not that you are ignorant of those things, but you know exactly where to go to find the answers that you need on the technical level, but you know how to put the pieces together from all of those technical experts. That's the key.
Yeah, I think that's a great insight. And of course, it can be challenging to develop those new skills while you still have your full workload and you want to maintain your reputation as the subject matter expert in the area that you've kind of defined yourself. But in parallel to that, I still now need to develop all these skills that are going to help me break through the glass ceiling, as you mentioned, whether it's communication style or just general leadership skills. And doing both at the same time can be hard. And I think my opinion is, you know, each level up you go within an organization is probably exponentially harder to get to that next rung. And the next one's probably 10 times harder. And the next one after that's probably 10 times harder than the last one, right? So these are real challenges. And hopefully, you know, what we're getting out of this conversation is helping people on that journey to at least be able to support or improve one area, which is executive communication. The other thing that kind of struck me, and I love that analogy you gave with Ferris Bueller's Day Off, great movie, you should check it out. And when you think about that economics professor played by the great Ben Stein, We've all probably seen people that are kind of like that, right? We've all can remember a Zoom call or a meeting or some other, maybe it was even during an interview where somebody was just boring us to tears. And we can all probably cite examples. But at the same time, we're all pretty sure that we've never done that. And at least some of us are wrong, right? And maybe we're not entirely self-aware that we've been that person to other people. And it's very hard to see that in yourself because you get caught up in, I'm busy, I need to get all this information out there, or maybe I'm tired that day, or I'm just not 100% in my game, or you know, there's a million reasons why that may end up being you. But we've all probably been guilty of that to varying degrees. And I think, you know, getting some external eyes on you and how you perform and getting that feedback can be so critical because it's very hard to, I think, self-diagnose in a lot of situations. So
actually, may I interject on that point?
Sure, of course. Jump in, please.
It is hard to self-diagnose in the moment. However, the fastest and most effective way to learn how to self-diagnose is to use the little phone that you got right next to you, I'm sure at arm's length, because welcome to the current world that nobody's ever got it more than arm's distance away. Turn on your video camera or just your audio memos, your voice memos, and record yourself talking. Maybe you're on a Teams meeting, maybe it's a Zoom call, but turn on your phone. Don't record everybody else, but just record a couple of moments of when you are contributing something. And then when you're done, when the meeting is over, go back and watch and listen. I guarantee every person out there has had those moments, even just at parties or get together where somebody makes a little selfie video or says, hey, you know, say hi to grandma or whatever it happens to be. And you make it. And as soon as you watch it, you look at yourself and you go, oh my gosh, that sounded so much better in my head. Or you look at your face and you say, what was I doing with my face? Why was I making that weird look? Or what was I doing with my hands? Why are we surprised? You were there. Right? You made it. You said it. And yet 10 seconds later, just watching it objectively, third party like on that video, you are suddenly painfully in some cases, but super crystal clear, aware on what did or did not come across as intended, where your message landed with the intention behind it and where you went, okay, I got to get a do-over. That did not work for me. I was trying to come across as funny or trying to come across as loving or trying to come across as enthusiastic or trying to come across as whatever it was. And oh, that did not land. Okay, I got to go fix that. So you can self-diagnose very quickly if you're willing to.
Actually, I have a question for you, Laura.
Yeah.
With COVID, we were all forced to look at ourselves way more than we ever probably wanted or thought we would on Zoom calls all day, every day. And you know how we always say the first time you see yourself on a video and you have to listen to your voice is always terrible because we're not used to it. So now all of a sudden we have to do it all the time. Did that change anything in terms of how you found clients or clients found you? Or was there a surge of people who said, oh my gosh, this is really not what I thought it was. I need to get some professional help.
Yes, as a matter of fact. And it, every now and then, the gods of timing smile upon us. And this was one that happened to work well for me. Pre-COVID, I was already coaching a lot of clients. I was using Skype at the time, but I was doing a lot of remote one-on-one coaching. And just before COVID hit, I decided to launch my own podcast. So I spent a lot of time researching how to create a studio, which is what I'm sitting in right now. So understanding lighting and setup and backgrounds and cameras and microphone differences and all those kinds of things. So I was ready to go. And just as I was launching, COVID hit and the world was suddenly thrown with their hair on fire into all virtual, all camera, all the time. They didn't have the equipment. They didn't know what to do with it. They didn't know how to show up. And they certainly didn't know how to engage with other people in that space. So I put out some offerings and I did webinars and I did trainings and I spoke at virtual conferences. And it was all about how to take your in-person best and bring it to the virtual world. Because I still feel like even now, 4 years in, people click join meeting and they still wish they could kind of rename themselves in their little windows with a disclaimer that says, I just want you to know, if you met me in person, you'd be impressed. But that kind of doesn't fly. So it's still important to always up-level our virtual presence, the way we sound, the way we look, the way we engage and stay connected with the other people, whether we're just a participant in a meeting or leading it one-on-one or 1 to 1,000. I've done all of the above and other. And yes, it is possible, and not just possible to do, but possible to do well, and just as well, if not better, than in person. So that was certainly for the first year or so, a really important revenue stream for me, considering my speaking calendar got wiped clean very fast. So stages weren't there, but screens and microphones were. And that's still something that I do a decent amount of training on.
I want to go back to the basics first, and hopefully we can cover virtual a little bit later, but let's talk about what are the skills 101 that everybody needs to know about how to communicate effectively, especially, as I said, in the setting of what our audience finds themselves in. Oftentimes it's interactions with or presentations to executives. So what is the bare minimum that everybody needs to really know?
Executive presentations, think of it this way. With any context, all audiences, and I use the word audience to mean whether you're talking to one person on a telephone call or presenting or on a podcast, whatever context, all audiences are tuning into the same radio station, WIFM. What's in it for me? Nobody's judging you. Nobody really cares what you had for breakfast or what's going on inside your brain. If you're talking to them, they're going, okay, how is this relevant for me? How am I going to use it? What do I need to know? What don't I need or want to know? Just give me what I need to be able to take back and do my own job better. I'd prefer it if you were interesting in the process, but think about it in terms of what am I going to do with this? Why do you think that I need to know that? And for that matter, do you know what it is that I do actually need to know? Are you aware of that? So starting from that perspective, everybody is worried about productivity, about doing their job better. Well, what's an executive's job? An executive's job, an executive being productivity, what is the product of an executive? It's decisions. So an executive is more effective, more successful in their job when they can make better decisions faster. So what is it about whatever your content is that you're presenting to this executive, individual, or team? And what decisions do they need to make that you are helping them with the information? So the mistakes that we tend to make are things like, okay, we get a little nervous. This is a high stakes presentation. We want to do a little CYA, which is cover your assets, so to speak. And we want to make sure that they know how hard we work. We want to make sure that they understand where we got our numbers. We often try to fire hose them and drown them in information, because as long as we give them all the background, then they understand everything, or we think they should. And then they can't ask us any questions because there's nothing left to ask. And because questions are scary and we're not in control of questions. So we make the mistake of approaching from that, let me cover myself approach, as opposed to, no, what do they need to know and why? What decisions are they depending on me to help them make? And approaching from that big picture strategic perspective, have the data ready. Have the appendices all ready to go. Have 1,000 appendices if you want. But don't front load all that data. Just give them the high level picture. And if you don't know what decisions they're trying to make ahead of time, ask. And then structure your presentation to help inform that decision-making process. That's what they want.
I think that's great advice, and something that's hard to remember sometimes, just sure. as busy as we all are. And I also really like your recommendation to record yourself so you can hear yourself afterwards. And I think there's a variety of different tools that potentially you could use there. One other one I would offer that's worked for me from time to time, if you're giving a presentation, if you have somebody that's going to be in the audience that's, let's say, a trusted peer, you know, you really, you know, trust them and you respect their opinion, ask them to give you some constructive criticism, constructive feedback after the presentation, and ask them, would you be willing to take some notes, and I really need some help, and would you be my eyes and ears in the audience so that you understand what the audience heard, not just in terms of what I think I said. And I've done that in a variety of different ways, and sometimes it's hard feedback to hear, but it's super useful. And even sometimes in content I create, I'll have others look at it. And that's a good exercise. Sometimes if I'm working on an important deck, I'll send it over to this person named Dr. Nario. And then she tells me how terrible it is. And I'll make all the improvements I need to make. But it's a helpful exercise, Nari, honestly.
That never happens.
Well, and it's nice even to have somebody in that moment, not just tell you feedback afterward. But for example, if you know that when you get nervous, you tend to talk fast, and you could preset that person as a plant somewhere easily visible, and tell them to give you a signal, like a third base coach kind of line, where are they going to be rubbing their chin with their hand or tugging on their ear or play with the rim on their baseball hat or whatever it happens to be? There probably isn't a baseball hat, but you know what I mean? What is the visual signal that indicates, slow down, dude, slow down, breathe? And that makes you go, oh, right. So those little hints in the moment can be really helpful.
Man, these are all simple things any of us could do. It's just being intentional about putting those things in place ahead of time. And so when professionals reach out to you because they need some help, right? They need some coaching. What are the common things? There's always a reason behind that, right? They don't usually pick up the phone and call you if they think everything's going well. They may be struggling with a particular challenge, or they just got a terrible beatdown in a meeting and realize they need some help. But what are the common things that people come to you with? Because I think that would help our audience understand a little bit more about the problems that you solve and hopefully make us all feel a little bit better that, hey, we're not alone in struggling with some of these issues.
Sure. So for example, succession planning is a really important issue. You get somebody who's the senior vice president of whatever, and they want to become the CXO, whether it's SVP of finance, become chief financial officer, or something moving in that direction. And often they're viewed as someone who is on the candidate list because they have the technical experience and they've got the historical expertise, the organizational knowledge, so to speak, but there's something missing. They're viewed, as we mentioned before, as being definitely an important member of the team, but does everyone see them as being the person who would be the leader who everybody would feel comfortable, would trust getting behind to lead the charge for the organization? And often there's something missing and people can't put their finger on what it is. They know it's not the technical skill. That's why they're in their job. That's why they're good at that stuff. As an example, there was a client that I worked with not long ago who was in that very situation, publicly traded company and several thousand people. And the board gave him a gift. They came to him in no uncertain terms and said, when you talk, we don't understand you, so fix it. Or when the CFO retires in a couple of years, we're going to find somebody else. So that doesn't feel like a gift, but it really is, because they made it exceptionally clear what had to happen. They didn't understand why. They couldn't figure out what the disconnect was. They just knew it wasn't effective the way they needed it to be. So they brought me in. That was my job, to figure out what the problem was. And it was many things. Being lost in part in what I like to call the expert's curse. You've been in your own space for so long, you forget what's not obvious to everybody else. You forget what's not interesting to everybody else. You forget what's not necessary or intuitive to everybody else. That's a big part. Talking strategically, telling stories, illustrating points, not getting lost in the jargon and lost in the weeds, all of those pieces. And a lot of it was also in the delivery. And whether it's about the organization and how much you need to scaffold information by providing a little bit of background and explaining some structural bits before then launching into the recommendations. And what was interesting with this particular person was that this is a common experience. And I know in pharma in particular, there's a lot of very international audience, very international players and employee bases. And there's often a concern about, well, what if I'm not a native speaker? Is this going to be something that holds me back? And what's amazing, I would say a third of my clients over the last two decades, maybe more, have been non-native speakers, have been international professionals from whatever background. The accent is a concern. He was from a different country originally. So the concern was, is it his accent? Is it because we're just not understanding the words? When we adjusted everything else, there were one or two places where, okay, we can address certain pronunciation pieces, but my job was to assess and where what is and isn't relevant to that. And when we fixed the other things, we got him to tell more stories, got him to slow down, got him to not get lost in the weeds, got him to structure and frame arguments differently, got him to engage actively the list, all those other pieces. Let's put it this way. A, they all thought his accent became a lot clearer, even though that had nothing to do with it, but somehow they didn't know what else. And this is the thing, non-experts don't know how to diagnose the situation. All they know is something's missing. We don't know what it is. The only thing we can put our fingers on and identify is what's kind of observable, what sounds different. So accents get scapegoated a lot because people don't know otherwise how to. They don't mean to. They're not trying to be racist or trying to be, they just know they're having a hard time understanding and they don't know whatever else it could be. So that ends up being the issue. Fix the other stuff. Your accent will be a lot, quote unquote, clearer to, or less of a distraction or less of a scapegoat for others. But point being, he's now CFO.
I love the success stories.
We like a success story. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. That's always nice to hear. So one point I wanted to make is you said this person received this gift. And I really do think it's a gift because he got very clear information and a roadmap and help. But oftentimes that's not the case. So nobody tells you that something is wrong for whatever reason. So you're left to your own devices, or worse, you don't even know that there's a problem. You just at some point realize you're stuck. And you mentioned that early on. Can you just highlight some of the most common mistakes or challenges just so that we have an idea of what is often out there and does not get addressed because people are uncomfortable giving feedback, or they just can't be bothered, or what, you know, there might be a lot of other reasons, but oftentimes we don't know what we don't know. And that's really a much worse situation. So what do you see? What are your top 10?
That's a long list.
Maybe top three then.
So let's see, as far as the what not to do. Well, most importantly, don't be passive in just waiting for information that may or may not be forthcoming. I think the flip side of that is do take a proactive approach to identifying what you need to work on. So if your company has its annual review process, look at what's on that. Now, some of them are very robust and go through all sorts of, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5 or scale of 1 to 10, rate this person on blah, blah, blah. Some of them are very general and much more anecdotal. But if there is no process for an annual review, then do some Googling, research annual review questions, even for your industry, for somebody in your level in particular, and make up a list of your own, and then find a time to sit down with your boss, sit down with your boss's boss, sit down with peers in other departments or in other companies, and ask, you know, what, if nothing else, there are, I think, 4 easy questions that I have done in workshops with people and had them do this in advance. Number one, what are my greatest strengths? You need to poll a bunch of people. What are my greatest strengths? What are my greatest weaknesses? What can you always depend on me for? And what would you not depend on me for? And I would pack on a 5th one in our context, which is for me to be viewed as someone who's ready for the next level. What would I have to demonstrate, or what would I have to change? Some people will also refer to those questions as, from a gardening perspective, the weeds, seeds, and leaves. So the weeds is, what's something that we should stop doing or something you would like me to do less of? The seeds is, what's something you'd like me to do more of? Something I should start doing. And leaves is, what's just working? What do we leave as it is? What's effective? And I would focus those in communication. When communicating with me as your boss, or when communicating with me as your employee, or for me to communicate with you as your employee, as your direct report, what do I do that's effective? How do you, giving feedback, receiving feedback, being proactive. You can ask all of these questions and just seek information. And what I do find is that if you're not in a culture or in a division or whatever that tends to be very open and proactive about these things, when asking for it, you'll need to explicitly give people permission to give you constructive feedback rather than just praise, because they will be very afraid of hurting your feelings. And very afraid of, in particular, to our earlier point, if you are of different ethnic backgrounds, if you are of different racial backgrounds, if you are of different gender backgrounds, if you are of different language backgrounds, the person giving constructive feedback, if you're not, again, in a very open culture, may be concerned that anything constructive, i.e. negative, that they say to you, if you don't like it, you could go back and report them to HR. As being biased in one way or another. So you really need to have a preemptive conversation with them to say, okay, here, I need this information. I'm interested in developing. I want to be ready down the line for more leadership roles. I want to start working on these things now. Help me know what I don't know. How can I improve? What am I doing well? What do I need to improve on? What don't I know that I need to be working on to be ready, rather than getting there and then having to figure it out? How can I prepare in advance for this kind of stuff? Please help me. Advise me, guide me, find a mentor, et cetera, and give them permission to be direct, and you're understanding that, and you can put it in writing if necessary, but that you are seeking constructive input for your own benefit, and you will receive openly and non-judgmentally whatever that may happen to be. Now, of course, watch the language, and it'll be, I'm not saying you should accept everything, and everything, of course, will be taken with a grain of salt, to say the least. But they do need to know that you're not going to complain on the whole. Assuming, if we assume best intentions, let's say that, put it out there, assuming best intentions on the part of both people, that it's not going to come back and bite them. So that is a little concern, unfortunately, of a lot of corporate America.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. It's so easy to either kind of believe our own hype or kind of selectively seek and listen to feedback that we like and that kind of reaffirms what we already believe about ourselves, which is nice to hear. On some days, we probably need that, but that doesn't necessarily help you grow. And you got to get uncomfortable to grow. So I think the only thing I'd add to that is, you know, certainly I think there's an argument that you want to reach out to people that you certainly trust because you're being a little bit vulnerable seeking that feedback. And I would suggest, with appropriate caution, reach out to people that maybe you don't have the best relationship with, or who's the person that when you think about asking them for input, you cringe a little bit, like, oh, I don't want to hear from that person. And then ask yourself, well, why don't you want to hear from that person? Maybe it's because you're not going to like what you hear. And it is an opportunity for growth. And you just have to, and I think if you approach it sincerely and authentically, people will respect that. Maybe you end up with a better relationship with this person than otherwise you would have had. And it just, again, goes back to getting out of your comfort zone. But we all need people that will give us that honest criticism. I'm lucky to have Dr. O, who gives me constant constructive criticism. Only for my own betterment.
There was an eye roll in there.
But you're still a great professional feedback partner as well, Nari. But I wanted to touch on something a little bit earlier that you mentioned that I think is a special maybe area of challenge for pharma professionals, although other industries as well. It's how do we communicate effectively complex data and evidence? So we're often in situations where in some ways the content is very data heavy. We've all been in presentations where we see a slide that's just top to bottom full of charts and figures and text, and you can barely read the darn thing, and the person's trying to work their way through it. So, I mean, separate from maybe the structure of the slide in particular, what are some things, though, that people can do to make that more engaging? Just focusing, I think, on the linguistics side, because it's a challenge, because, you know, you can't just ignore the data. I mean, it needs to be communicated, but how do you communicate it in an effective, engaging way that meets the audience's needs?
You know, it's interesting. Part of linguistics is the context cues. And you mentioned, okay, well, aside from the design of the slide themselves, I can't overemphasize the importance of those slides and how you are designing them. Because if you look at a slide and it directly influences people's ability to hear what you're saying, but if you look at a slide and you feel this compulsion to preface with, you probably can't read this, but... that's a disaster. Just set it on fire. Just hit the delete button, because that automatically makes people tune it out and tune you out, because that is an ego slide. You put that up there because it just made you feel better to know your information is there, but that is not in service of the audience.
Yeah, you're telling them not to pay attention at that point.
Right. And to the extent that something is very dense, legible, but super dense, too much on it, maybe a chart on one side and a graph on the other, or a bunch of bullets on one side and a table on the other, people are looking all over the place and they're trying to read it and make sense and skim and put the pieces together. And you can't listen and read at the same time and process both. Most people in today's world are biased towards visual input. So if there's truckloads of stuff smashed onto that slide, they will be reading and trying to make sense out of what they see. And I'll mix my culture entertainment metaphors, but you relegate yourself to Charlie Brown's teacher. All they hear from you is wah, 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 because they're looking at other things and you're talking about whatever it is that you're talking about. So you do need to have as little information on one slide as possible. I mean, I've worked with people in finance where the spreadsheets are massive. They just import a big chunk out of Excel and stick it on a spreadsheet. But then when we look at what they're talking about, it's really only a couple of rows and a couple of columns or a couple of cells. Why do we need to have that whole sheet on there? Especially because it makes them mostly want to preface with, you probably can't see this, but. So really, how do you carve it down to just what people need to do? I worked with somebody who was the CFO, and his issue was perpetually going through too much of the data in the spreadsheet. They don't need you to go through the cell by cell. They read it already. It's the board you're talking to, board of directors. They did their homework. They don't need you to walk through the whole thing. They want you to tell them what's behind the data. What's the story that's, put it in context. What's the so what of this slide? So illustrate your points, that complex data, that all of that evidence, translate it for them. Don't just regurgitate it for them. That's a massive point of distinction. Can you interpret the data? Can you give an illustration of what it did look like, does look like, or will look like, and why? That's the stuff people can't necessarily interpret for themselves.
I totally agree. I think the value add for the presenter, and you've said this, is the interpretation and your insights. It's not the data themselves, right? The data there is support your interpretation and insights. And if you don't have interpretation or insights to offer, then you really are not needed as a presenter, right? I mean, what's your value standing up there in front of this audience? And I think that's tough to remember sometimes. We get stuck in the data itself.
Correct. Yes, you relegate yourself as obsolete if you're just reading what's on the slide or in the spreadsheet, et cetera. What value are you creating? And we forget also that you spent days, weeks, months, years creating, compiling, analyzing that data. They just looked through it once. They might have flipped back and forth a couple of times, but they just tried to ingest this giant compilation of documents that you sent them. They didn't have as much time as you do. So can they understand it? Yes. Do they understand what you need them to understand from it? Absolutely not. So spoon feed it to them. That's your job.
Okay, so Laura, do you recommend having two different versions? So you send out a pre-read that has all the information, hopefully it has some sort of story flow behind it. But then when you get to the presentation, like you said, we don't want to compete with our own information on a slide that's usually way busier than it should be. And arguably, the way we use PowerPoint generally is probably not the most effective anyway. Would you recommend just having a different version so that you can be in control of the story?
Nari, you just made my heart happy with that question. Yes, is the easy answer, because we use PowerPoint really for two different purposes. One is just a more visually attractive version of a Microsoft Word document or a Excel spreadsheet of some sort, but we're really just creating a file that we want people to read on their own, whether it's a read ahead or a leave behind, it's self-access. And to Ian's earlier point, those documents don't need someone to walk you through it. They are supposed to be standalone documents, at which point you are obsolete as presenter. The other version is the PowerPoint deck that is intended to be presented as a presentation by a presenter, and that's you. So yes, we absolutely, to the extent that we want to keep the number of slides to a minimum. No, what does it matter how many slides there are if it's still an hour worth of content? Or 1,000 data points, whether it's on 10 slides or 100 slides spread out, it's still that much data and it's still going to take you that much time to go through it. So I have a couple of commandments, so to speak, about creating slides that maximize engagement, maximize comprehension, maximize retention. And yeah, one of them is what I like to call the $200 is $200 rule. If you've got kids, if you've ever been a kid, imagine your teenager comes home and says to you, Mom, Dad, can I have $200? I need to buy a new pair of sneakers. And you look at them and go, $200? My shoes don't even cost $200. What do you need that kind of money for? And they say, but it's really not that much. See, because you only have to give me two bills. But I'm bumching. I'll be here all day. But point being, it doesn't matter if it is two Bens or 200 Georges. It's still 200 units of currency. Similarly, if I have 100 points smashed onto 10 slides or 100 points one by one over 100 slides, there's so much. I mean, I'm not using exactly the, I wouldn't recommend A or B, but it's still going to take you however much time to go through those 100 points. And when it comes to what, again, as a cognitive linguist, what's going to help the audience understand and retain what you've said, the one by one, just let me focus like a horse with blinders on, show me one thing as you're talking about it. When you move on to your next topic, show me the next thing, as opposed to giving me this giant mess of stuff on the screen where I'm going to read all 10 faster than you finish talking about number two. And then I'm going to look at my phone and check my text messages or my emails while I wait for you to catch up.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to wait for you. There's so many reasons why the $200 is $200 rule is so much better. And so many companies are misguided in their general rule of thumb, because that's how we've always done it. Philosophy of, well, we just like to keep things to as few slides as possible. They're not saying as minimal content as possible. They're just saying take 12 slides worth of stuff and smash it into three, because we only want to give each person three slides. That's the dumbest parameter ever.
The way to get around that is you build a lot of animations into those three slides.
That's some of it. Yes. Yes. If nothing else. Absolutely. And that's part of rule number, commandment number two, which we'll get into on a different conversation.
Okay. That's great. I want to hear all of those. One rule I try to follow is that ideally, when I have to give a presentation, I could give it even if, for whatever reason, I couldn't access my slides. So I personally think that I still have to know what I'm talking about. And actually, that did happen to me once. I had a presentation to senior leadership and randomly the power went out. So for me, I think that's one of the very helpful tips, that you need to still in your head have the story ready, regardless of what happens with your slides.
And that also goes to the importance of delivery, going back to the original question that I believe Ian asked as far as that content versus delivery piece, because you can have your notes in front of you, you can have your prints or something so that you can reference if you need a little bit of prompting through your various presentations. But if there's nothing for the audience to look at except you, then even more, you need to be able to connect with the audience. You need to be able to engage them. Your delivery is going to matter a lot more.
So that leads me perfectly to my next question. I want to expand from executive communication to executive presence, the dreaded executive presence that oftentimes is very nebulous and people use it as a weapon. This person doesn't have executive presence. What does that mean? Can you build it? Can you acquire it? Or is that like a death sentence? If somebody doesn't have executive presence, they might as well go look for a new job. I liked in your video that you actually really broke down what it takes to successfully communicate or effectively communicate. And it's a lot more than what we normally think about. And you just alluded to it. It's not just the content, which we spend a lot of time on, as you said, building PowerPoint slides for weeks and months. It's not even just how you say it, but it's more than that. So it's you. And I hope that you can talk to us about that a little bit. But I also think that earlier in the conversation, you brought it back to, you start way in the beginning. If you have a successful plan, you have to actually have a plan. Oftentimes people just focus on, okay, I have to get through this presentation, but we don't think about who's the audience, what do they need? So it's much more complex. And I really like that about your TEDx talk. But in terms of executive presence, let's come back to that. So what is it going to take? Let's say, just like what I described, you have no PowerPoint slides. So you get an additional challenge to present to somebody important and you cannot use PowerPoint. How do I do this?
Those are two very big issues. So one is, how do you define executive presence? And the other is, what do you do in that kind of specific situation? And I've been there as well. If I can go back to the operationalizing executive presence, so that it's not just that black box X factor kind of a thing, which can be weaponized if it's just somebody's way of broadly justifying not promoting or hiring you, just claiming that you don't have it. And so, oh well. One thing that I referenced in my TED talk was a study that was done a little while ago, but I think it's still very relevant, by the Center for Talent Innovation. And it is defining executive presence. And they surveyed a few hundreds of or thousands of executives across the country to get their take on what that is. And they really broke it down into three big pillars, which they labeled as appearance being the smallest, that you do have to look the part. You can't be a slob. You can't be whatever. Communication skills and gravitas, which they labeled as the largest one. And gravitas is things like, are you willing to make the unpopular decisions? Do you have enough technical expertise, knowledge to be able to hold your own in that space? Do your words have teeth? If you threaten that if X happens, then Y will be the result. And then it happens. Are you willing to carry through on what you said that you were going to do? There's a million things. And so they really operationalized those pieces very, very well and in a lot of detail. It's a great study to read through, even if you only look through the executive summary at the beginning. For communication skills, I don't personally understand, and I do see how they went through and they said communication skills require stuff like, how's your public speaking and how is this and how's that? But for me, you can't extricate communication skills from everything else. I don't see how you can have gravitas and how your words can have teeth if you aren't clear in what you say, authoritative and confident in how you present them, the sound of your voice, your body language. Do you take up space when you talk, or do you seem to shrink back and want to blend into the wallpaper? There are so many elements involved. So I think for anybody who's unclear about, well, do I have executive presence? Do I need executive presence? Where do I or don't I? What? Go find that study. It was from 2013, the Center for Talent Innovation. I believe it's publicly available now. But just look at the categories that they have, because it's not rocket science. That's the beauty of it. And when you start to think about it in those concrete terms, do I do this? Do I demonstrate that? What observable behavioral evidence do I have of yes or no? Or does somebody else have of yes or no? Then it helps us to be very clear on what else we need to do to start to show up as someone who does have executive presence. There is a difference between authoritative and authoritarian. Authority is not a bad thing, but that's a massively important distinction. There's equally a difference between commanding respect and demanding respect. If you have to demand it, pounding your fist on the table and say, you will respect me, good luck. People may defer to you. They will not respect you. There's a way that you communicate, a way that you interact with people, what you say, how you say it, your voice, your body language, that makes people sit up and take notice, that makes people lean in, that makes people give you the benefit of the doubt. That commands respect just inherently in the way that you show up. That commands trust. That establishes credibility that people give you voluntarily because you've just naturally compelled them to do so. That's what we're trying to establish in that executive presence.
What you just said reminds me of the surprisingly heated debate about Elizabeth Holmes's voice.
Yes.
The infamous CEO of Theranos back in the day.
Yes, yes.
People were really debating, was her voice that deep or not? And I, funny story, I know somebody who knows somebody who used to date her, apparently. And that person said, no, her voice is not that deep. But sidebar. But I do think, yes, it's really, as you said multiple times now, it's not just what you talk about and how you say it. It's how you present yourself, right? Because you are the messenger. And so it covers everything from appearance to body language to facial expressions to eye contact. And I think we sometimes forget that. We focus too much on, this is the content. They asked me a technical question, so here are the facts. But the messenger is as important as the message.
Absolutely. In the world of investments, whether it's tech startups or pharma companies or anything else, you're looking for investment dollars. Well, venture capitalists, angel investors, anybody else, there's one commandment that's at the top of all when they're evaluating whether or not to invest in a particular organization. And that is bet the jockey, not the horse. Meaning, of course, it's great if the drug or the IP or whatever that this organization is building is good and has good market promise. But does the CEO, does the founder, does the person at the helm or in the saddle, as the case may be, seem to have what it takes to be able to get that horse across the finish line? The best pure thoroughbred horse, if ridden by an amateur jockey, is not going to win. So do you come across as someone who has what it takes to turn that particular idea into a massive success as an organization? You're the jockey, and they need you to be more than just somebody who's really smart. That's not enough.
One additional thing I'd love to explore is if you have any guidance or advice for what to do in the moment if things aren't going well. So here's what I mean. We've probably all been in that situation where you're presenting and maybe you're halfway through and you realize this is not going great, right? I'm losing the audience. I see people are on their phones or sidebar chatter. There's, you know, you have that sense of dread, like, oh my gosh, this is not going the way I had hoped it would go. But I'm only halfway through. Maybe there's time to salvage this situation. And I think sometimes you might just forge ahead because you don't have a plan B, or you panic a little bit and you just randomly try to improve the situation. Is there anything that we can do in the moment? And these would be folks maybe that didn't do the prep and didn't take all the advice that you've given and didn't have time to do that. What can we do in the moment to try to course correct? Is that possible?
Yes, it's always possible. Going back to the gravitas, some of the ways to demonstrate that authority of sorts, if you see that you're losing your audience, can you stop in the middle and with confidence and ownership, not shrinking or falling to pieces, say, you know what, let me pause for a second here. I'm getting the sense that I'm losing the group. There's an energy shift here. What do you need that you're not hearing? Or where am I missing the mark? Help me to give you what you're looking for.
But that's a scary question, right, to ask. Not disagreeing that it's the thing to do, but that can be a scary thing to take on.
It is, but you're already lost them.
Yeah.
You know in your gut that they're not with you. You're not getting eyes, or the eyes you're getting are kind of sleepy, or the posture is slumped over, or you know that they're not with you. So you can just continue to go down that path and basically forfeit, or you can own it. And look, everybody's made mistakes at times. I've certainly been in trainings and presentations where I'll see, not long ago, I was with a group and there was all this at one point that I hit on, and I watched a couple of people's faces just react very emotionally, like, what did she just say? I have to do what? No. And I saw somebody else shaking her head like, no, no, no. So I stopped and I was like, great, I appreciate your direct input, nonverbally or otherwise. Tell me what the head shake is for. Tell me what that facial expression is. Tell me what's going on. What's the context where this is not resonating? And then as they gave me the context, I went, okay, so that's an important detail, because you know that the person that you're preparing for in the moment has made it explicitly clear that his preference is for X. Now, is that something that is generally an optimal approach? No, but if the boss wants that, give it to the boss. It's not, that's the way he's done it. That's the way he likes it. When I'm doing a training, unless it's a particular, so like in pharma, in healthcare, I have worked with teams to prepare RFPs. And those requests for proposals, et cetera, that's for a board that's got a very set understanding, but you don't know who the individual is. You don't know who's going to make up that board. You don't know what their history or their preferences are, et cetera. So you go towards a general type of presentation. That's different from when you're going to present to the CEO who's very stuck on, no, I like things done this way. I don't like this color. I like this structure. I want to see this information first, not that. Give him what he wants. The whole point is, what's in it for me? Play to your audience. If most people like chocolate and this is the one person who likes vanilla, make it vanilla for this person. That's okay. There is no commandment that's universal, except that there's no commandment that's universal. Give the audience what they want. Give the audience what they want.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. Great words to live by.
Great way to close this conversation. There were so many great tips in here. Laura, thank you very much for breaking it down for us. It's very actionable. I think a lot of this is what we always hear. You know, you own your development, you have to do the work, which is true. But I think you also really change maybe people's perspectives. I mean, you changed my perspective a little bit on, it's not a bad thing. Like all these things that you described that can seem scary, like recording yourself or directly asking for feedback in a kind of high stakes situation, all of those things, we can flip that on its head and say, because you have the power to do that. It's a decision that you make and it might be a little bit painful in the moment, but what's the alternative? If we don't do it, we're not going to get better. And I think if you do the work now, you don't have to do the work later.
Correct. And it shows a different side of leadership. Again, beyond the person who is the technical expert to present this content in the moment, we talked about before that linguistic glass ceiling, about what else do I need to show? What kinds of leadership skills to be able to stop, show that you have the emotional intelligence to be able to read a room, acknowledge that something's missing, and own it without falling apart. A leader needs to have humility. A leader needs to be able to recognize when something's not working. A leader needs to recognize when it's time to course correct or to apologize if they made a mistake or to do all of those kinds of things, but in a way that doesn't lose face. Somebody pointed out, actually a priest friend of mine years ago pointed out, that the distinction between humiliation and humility is that humiliation strips away dignity, but humility restores it. So to the extent that you screwed something up, yeah, you made a mistake and you're going to lose face. You're going to lose some points to everybody else. But if you acknowledge it, you own it, and you fix it, and you're not hiding and pretending that it didn't happen, it's like, oh, that person's got some chutzpah. They've got some strength. That's a leader that I would trust more than someone who's just going to pretend that it didn't happen and hope that we didn't notice it. That's not a leader. Just being able to own that. Once I was leading a training for Cisco, the tech company, and it was going through my standard training. And at one point, all of a sudden, I heard a couple of boos. And I went, wait, what? That's not normally something I get in the middle. And I turned and I looked at the slide and I realized what I had on there was a picture of a Zoom setup. Oops. So for anybody out there who doesn't understand why she just laughed, Nari, why did you just laugh?
Well, you were with Cisco and you showed Zoom.
Because Cisco makes WebEx. It's a competitor.
Yes, exactly. So you showed the direct competition.
Exactly. So now I can tuck my tail between my legs and slink out of there and be glad that they paid me up front. Or I can fix the situation. So I stopped and I said, and I actually just jokingly, I kind of booed along with them. And I went, oh, boo, bad presenter. Shame on you. Never do that. Never do that. Okay. But now let's look at why this happened. Let's make this a teachable moment. And I was very metacognitive with them. I said, like, let's look at what happened. Let's look at why this happened and let's turn this. I literally said, let's turn this into a teachable moment. I work hard to find the right images, find the right whatevers to put in my programs. And so why did I pick this one and not a WebEx? Frankly, because I didn't find them. I look for stuff that is images that are high quality, et cetera, et cetera. Why didn't I find any readily available? Now, I should have looked for one for this training. That's not the point. But why don't I have a Cisco WebEx image as a default here? I said, why is not the... That's not the important part, but who's going to partner with me to fix it? Who's going to send me a high quality image of a WebEx graphic that I can substitute and use that as my new default for video conference imaging moving forward in my trainings? A bunch of hands went up. I said, good. Are we good here? Can we move forward? Have we come to a resolution? All the heads nodded and we moved on. I can't tell you, that was a room full of about 75 national sales leaders. And a bunch of them came up to me afterwards and said, I am so glad that happened. That was the best part of the program because I got to watch it in action. That was amazing. So own it.
So you should have just told them, first of all, I show the picture of Zoom because they make more money. So this is your motivation. And second, I totally planned that. Right. No, but I think that was great. Thank you for sharing that example. It's always nice to hear how this actually works in real life, right? You are the expert and you still sometimes maybe have a slip up. So all of us can feel okay about our own slip ups. And that's where we're here to learn from you. Thank you for sharing that, Laura.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And then my last question for you is, and you just mentioned your priest friend, and I thought that was a really nice story about the difference between two terms that really mean very different things. In your career, have there been any other people, moments, experiences that have really helped guide your professional path? Because you help a lot of people. So you have that passion to help people be better at their jobs, be happier. Is there something or somebody that has done that for you?
There have been many along the way. Early, you know, I'm a quote unquote recovering academic. So I was a professor and researcher originally, turned executive coach and entrepreneur, et cetera. And there were two people who really helped me with a shift in that early on. One, before I had left academia at all or even looked outside of it, saw what I was doing, my research, and said to me, you know, I feel like I've always had an instinct about what you do, but not the data to back it up. You have the data. Would you come into a training for my team? And he happened to be the vice president of government programs at IBM. And all of a sudden, you know, so he had the vision to see the application and the relevance of my work. And that was my first consulting gig, as it were. And that gave me a taste of a whole different world of opportunity. And then somebody else who, Grace Killalay, who does amazing work. She was an HR executive at Comcast for a long time and then hung out her own shingle under Half the Sky leadership. She was in, along with everybody else, in that training of executive presence and working with people in succession planning. And when she saw the work that I was doing and where my work originally was focusing on voice, because people would talk about the gravitas part and they would talk about presentation skills and those things, but they weren't looking at the nuances of the mechanism of the voice and those kinds of small cues and the massive, massive impact they make and how much we don't realize that we have control over all of it, leveraging it as a tool, as an instrument. She looked at my emphasis in that space and she said to me, Laura, your work is a game changer. And that was validation for me early on 10, 12 years ago that said, okay, I think I'm onto something. If someone like that looks at my work and says, you complement us because you fill in a blank that we don't do, that was hugely important for me in really staking my claim, putting my flag in the ground, as it were. So thank you to Chris and to Grace.
That's really nice. We all need somebody who does that for us sometimes, right?
Yeah. Who sees something in us that we don't see in ourselves.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Well, thank you so much for the time. This has been a wonderful discussion. There's so many things coming out of this discussion that I can certainly apply to help me in my work. And I hope others feel the same way. Laura, where can our listeners find you and learn more about how to improve their own executive communication skills?
Thank you, Ian. Of course, the easiest place is to go to my website, very simply, laurasekola.com. You can also check out my podcast, a weekly show called Speaking to Influence, Communication Secrets of the C-Suite. So I'm always interviewing executives from for-profit and nonprofit organizations just about the role of communication as an essential leadership skill. My LinkedIn profile, feel free to reach out, connect with me. And if you do, let me ask everyone to let me know that you heard me here on Real Pharma with Ian and Nari. And of course, there's my book, which is called Speaking to Influence, Mastering Your Leadership Voice. And that's available on Amazon as well as Audible. Although after this hour, if you're tired of the sound of my voice, don't do the Audible version.
And we'll link to all of these resources in the show notes as well for our audience.
Great. Perfect.
Thank you so much, Laura. It was wonderful to speak with you.
Thank you both.
Thank you. Bye now.
I thought that was a really fascinating and interesting and educational conversation with Laura. I actually jotted down some key takeaways, and I wonder if you agree with those. So I'm going to tell you what they are. Okay. Number one, know your audience. So you really need to understand, who are you talking to and what do they want from you? Why should they listen to you? What information are you going to bring to them that's going to make their lives easier? Number two, even though this may be a little bit difficult sometimes, give yourself feedback. I liked her suggestion to record yourself, which nobody likes, but it probably gives you some idea of what you really look and sound like. And number three is get feedback from others. So both of these are about actually looking at what's there, because we can't really improve if we don't know what's not working well. And number four, I think she empowered all of us to say we are as important as the messenger. But on the other hand, it also means you have to take that responsibility on. And it starts with things like, do you have the right plan? Do you come across the right way? Are you doing the right things in terms of how you show up? Your voice, your facial expressions, your gestures, your appearance, your posture, all of these things that we don't necessarily associate with giving a presentation or communicating effectively. And so for me, it was a really tangible and pragmatic kind of lesson from Laura in terms of, what do we owe the audience? But also, we have the power to make those changes if needed. So I really like that.
Yeah, I thought it was a great discussion too. And I certainly agree with all of your points. And I also like how pragmatic or applicable some of the advice that she gave was. We can take that with us and hopefully build on that or use that to just be more effective in our work. And the one thing I'll add, it was kind of my key takeaway, is, you know, we end up being, I think, so focused on our content because we spent all this time creating it and it's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to get your slides just the way you want. And I think sometimes we forget to ask the questions, what do we want the audience to believe? What do we want the audience to feel? What do we want the audience to do? And maybe that might resonate with some of the marketers that might be listening in, but you really need to think about your audience and the objectives you have for the interaction versus your content, because remember, the content is just a tool to help you achieve your objectives. The content is not the end game as a standalone. So, you know, it's always good to remind ourselves of that. I think it's an easy mistake to make. I've certainly made it. And I think a lot of Laura's advice, I think, kind of supports that idea as well. So another great discussion, a lot of fun. I'm sure we'll have Laura back. If anybody needs some support from somebody like Laura, please reach out to her, because I know she does a great job in supporting her clients.
And she also gave us a reference that we should link in the show notes, which is the Center for Talent Innovation on Executive Presence. And just as a teaser, I haven't read it yet, but I saw that it states that executive presence accounts for 26% of a promotion-related decision. So just in our own self-interest, it's probably a topic that we should all engage with more.
I agree. Great factoid. All right. Thanks so much, Nari. Another great episode down, and look forward to the next one.
Bye, Ian.
Thank you for listening. Please visit us at realpharma.co for more valuable resources. Real Pharma is brought to you by Black Canyon Ventures.
And that's a wrap on today's episode of Real Pharma. We hope our dose of pharmaceutical discourse has left you in good spirits and has increased your titers of knowledge.
Absolutely. If you found today's pill-packed adventure as stimulating as a shot of epinephrine, we'd love for you to show us some brand loyalty.
Yes, drop us a like and leave a review. It's the best prescription for podcast success.
Think of your review as the little booster shot that keeps our show in tip-top shape.
And hey, don't just keep us as your secret remedy. Share the good vibes and let others in on our Real Pharma therapeutic sessions.
So hit that review button like it's the perfect cure for a long commute. Your feedback is the treatment that keeps us going.
Thanks for tuning in, and remember, an episode a day keeps the boredom away.
Stay curious, stay healthy, and keep this podcast prescription handy for biopharma stories and insights.
See you next time.
Bye.